I'm Mary Harris. You are listening to WNYC. Why can't Americans stop fighting about sex? That is the question at the heart of Marie Griffith's new book, Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. In it, she traces 100 years of American history and how the fight for gender equality has shape-shifted over time. Griffith is the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where she directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics. Her book is published by Basic Books, and I am so thrilled it brings her to our show today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So before we go back in time, which we will, I want to start in the now, because just this week, Doug Jones was elected to be a senator in Alabama, defeating Republican Roy Moore, who'd been accused of sexual impropriety. So how do you understand what happened there?
Well, I think the thing to understand is how he almost didn't get elected, despite the charges against Roy Moore, right? That even though he eked it out in the end, surprisingly to many, the fact remains that countless numbers of white Alabamians voted for someone who is credibly accused of child molestation. It's really quite astonishing. And we know that the rates of white evangelical voters were quite high in Moore's favor.
Were you surprised by the election results?
Well, I think I've been a little surprised all along the way. I mean, I'm perennially surprised, maybe, and sort of disappointed. You know, Christians, of course, have been really strict about sexual morality. That's part of the point of my book, is sort of looking at all the different ways that they've been exceedingly strict about certain rules and marriage and gender hierarchy and all of that. And then suddenly that seems to fall apart. I think what it shows us is how tied many conservative white Christians still are to the politics of abortion and anti-gay, anti-LGBT issues.
You know, it was really interesting to me as an observer to just kind of watch the Christian right twist a little bit, trying to figure out how they could keep ideologically supporting him. I mean, was there a moment where you were watching and you said, oh my gosh, how are they doing this?
Well, of course, they'd already supported Donald Trump at extremely high levels, who was credibly accused of all kinds of things, and you know, misogyny, racism, sexual assault, you name it. So I think we've seen that before. You know, the most credible explanation is what scholars and journalists refer to as Christian nationalism. And, you know, basically just sort of this idea that, you know, God has a plan for the nation and God might bring leaders to power whom we don't necessarily like, but that's God's plan. And so, you know, we support them even if their lives are immoral.
You know, you argue that there is a historical and religious preoccupation with sex in this country. What are the roots there?
Well, Christianity itself, of course, as a tradition, has a long preoccupation with sex. It really doesn't go back to Jesus so much, who had very little to say about sex and sexual morality, as much as to Paul and some of the early Christian leaders there, who were consumed, of course, with celibacy and felt that sex was very dangerous and perhaps in some deep way very evil. So there have been centuries of Christian ambivalence about sex and sexuality, even as, of course, church teachings have, you know, promoted the family and promoted reproduction and all kinds of things. But that ambivalence goes very, very deep. I just think it's taken particular forms in the American context.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like a particularly American conversation, and I just wonder why that is.
Right. Well, you know, I sort of look back at the late 19th century, early 20th century context when really you had a kind of consensus. Most Americans and certainly most Christians had a sort of consensus view that sex belonged only in marriage, that men should rule over women and children. You know, there were gender hierarchies and just particular rules. And of course, that marriage was heterosexual and, you know, all these assumptions. And it's really in that early 20th century context of women's rights and women getting the right to vote, that some of that begins to crack apart.
Yeah. I mean, talk about some of the fears at the heart of this. I mean, you talk about the suffrage movement and how that really began this debate we've been having.
Yeah, one thing we forget about the suffrage movement is how many Americans opposed it and were very, very strongly opposed to women getting the right to vote. There was a fear that women would be defeminized, that somehow having equality with men would damage their reproductive organs. It would
really?
Sort of. Yes, Grover Cleveland himself suggested as much, and many other leaders as well, women as well as men, who feared this somehow. So there was something very threatening about de-womanizing women, and suddenly women wouldn't want to be mothers or wives or do traditional feminine things. They would just sort of go off and lead these decadent kinds of selfish lives. It was a deep fear among the anti-suffragist side at the time.
You know, part of what I love about your book is that you tell these stories of Americans who have been trying to shift the conversation about sex and politics for like a century. And I want to talk about some of them. I wonder if we can start with Margaret Sanger and the role that she played.
Oh, sure. Margaret Sanger is just such a fascinating figure. She started as a nurse, of course, and in her work among the poor in Brooklyn, she saw the terrible ravages of women not being able to control their reproductive lives, women having baby after baby after baby in conditions of extreme poverty, often with men who couldn't or wouldn't provide for them, and just horrific conditions. And this is really what inspired Margaret Sanger's promotion of birth control. She promoted it actually as a quite conservative cause. You know, it would also improve happiness in marriage. It would enable people to control when and how many children that they had. So she's a really fascinating figure who, of course, has been excoriated over the years in all kinds of ways.
Who is she fighting on this?
Well, the interesting thing is her biggest enemy in the 1920s, which is where I focus my attention on her, was the Catholic Church. Hmm. The more she tried to talk publicly about birth control and accessing birth control and sort of moral value of birth control, the Catholic hierarchy really, in essence, tried to suppress that public conversation. And she managed to turn that to her own advantage. The New York press and other press kind of saw her as a victim of Catholic authoritarianism and oppression, which really enabled the tides to turn around birth control in America in a very short time.
Hmm. You know, she organized the first American birth control conference, which led to the formation of Planned Parenthood. She felt this could be like a turning point for the birth control movement. What happened there?
That's right. So that was 1921 in November, the first major birth control conference ever that there had ever been. She brought in physicians and specialists from England and all across the United States. It was this enormous event. And the culminating speech was to be hers, giving an address on birth control, is it moral, in the newly built town hall there in Manhattan. And what happened when she got there, the doors were locked against her. The police were trying to shut the meeting down, and they had been given a call, it later turned out, by some members of the New York Archdiocese who wanted to prevent this public conversation from happening. So that's really the point at which she managed to shift the tides, as I said, on this issue.
What did that look like when she shifted the tides? Like, was it just public opinion really turned in her favor? What happened?
Well, the newspapers, the New York Times, magazines like The New Republic and The Nation, all sort of saw this as the Catholic Church's authoritarianism. Remember, America had a lot of anti-Catholicism throughout the 19th century, and it was still very live in that period. There was a lot of fear that Catholics really wanted to make natural law into the law of the land for everyone and impose their Catholic moral worldview on everyone else. So she harnessed that sort of anti-Catholic energy and showed people, as she saw it, that that's exactly what they were trying to do in her case, and that if people didn't fight this kind of takeover, you know, who knew what would happen? The nation itself was really in peril.
It's funny. It really sounds like it's setting the stage for the debate for what came next. It's always a debate about authoritarianism versus freedom.
Right. Well, I feel like I've seen that all along the way. You know, from birth control, we look at censorship and obscenity laws, interracial sex and marriage, the debates over the Kinsey reports in the late 1940s and 1950s, and women's sexual activity, things that were going on that were sort of against the mores of the time. And all along the way, you have this reaction against that kind of knowledge, those sorts of conversations in the public by people who thought that it would degrade the morals of the nation.
You know, you make this point in your book that fears about sex and race, you kind of alluded to it there, get really mixed up in America. And you talked about the suffrage movement and said some of the strongest resistance came from the Jim Crow South. Why was that?
Yes, that's right. And that's a key part of it, sort of looking. I look around the World War II period and at the debates that were happening over interracial sex and marriage and relationships and, of course, early debates around segregation and desegregation. There was really this fear that if you gave women, you know, once women had equality with men and women had the right to vote, that might extend to black women, too. That had been a real concern in the early 20th century with the suffrage movement. So by the 1940s, there's a strong resistance against African American women and men having the same rights as whites. And this broke out in the halls of Congress and all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, and you talk about women who tried to fight these sort of twinned sexism and racism debates. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about Ruth Benedict.
Yeah, so Ruth Benedict is a figure I focus centrally on there. She was an anthropologist who came out of Columbia University, a student of Franz Boas, and of course very famous for her book Patterns of Culture, which was a bestseller at the time. But she's interesting to me here because she also wrote a pamphlet or co-wrote it with another younger anthropologist called The Races of Mankind. And this was written in 1943. It was to be distributed to soldiers and military personnel all over the world who were fighting in World War II. And part of the point of this book was to counter the anti-Semitism in Germany and to say, you know, race really doesn't exist. You know, there are no races. These are human constructs that we've put on skin color and difference and all of that. And then the extension of that is if race itself doesn't exist, there's no reason why people can't date and love each other and get married and reproduce across the color line. And once these Jim Crow senators and representatives in Congress got wind of that, that was just fueled enormous fire among people who felt that she was, you know, destroying the sacred segregation that on which the South stood.
And what's so strange is that the Margaret Sangers of the world were also tied to the eugenics movement. So they're doing a lot of different things at once.
Well, that's right. And eugenics is the thing in some ways that Margaret Sanger has been, of course, most excoriated for in recent years. And it's sort of become a convenient way to just dismiss her, to say that, well, she was a eugenicist, therefore her entire movement is suspect. Planned Parenthood itself is suspect. It's a eugenic organization and so forth. But of course, we know that the vast majority of white elite Americans in her social class were also themselves eugenicists in some ways, including Catholics, many Catholics. So she herself was sort of in favor of, you know, that people should reproduce and have the best children, trying to kind of minimize the numbers of the unfit or the defective, as were the terms used widely at the time. But this wasn't really her key issue around birth control. Her key issue, and I hope I show this in the book itself, really is about women's empowerment and happiness in marriage, as she saw it, that birth control could bring.
And of course, she shifted the name from the birth control, from being birth control to Planned Parenthood. And
right.
That was a real change.
That's right.
You know, people of faith were also really involved in the sex education movement. You bring up the story of Mary Calderon. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yeah, so Mary Steichen Calderon, another New Yorker, she was a very devout Quaker and a physician who had worked for Planned Parenthood, actually, as the medical director in the 1950s. And in the early 1960s, she left Planned Parenthood to form the Sex Information and Education Council of the United States, SECUS, which is still around. And it was an organization that was there to sort of help facilitate sex education programs in venues like public schools, but also religious organizations, really anywhere where people wanted to have some kind of improved sex education over the programs that they had before. And much of her conviction about this really stemmed from deep spiritual and religious conviction. She made that point over and over and over again, that she wasn't some secularist coming to secularize America or bring about a sexual revolution. She was really about sort of compassion and education and getting people to think morally and come up with their own moral systems, for sure, but not imposing them on her. She was, though, attacked very vigorously by some fundamentalists led by Billy James Hargis, who was an anti-communist crusader, among other things, who was very opposed to these sex education programs in the public schools. And he very successfully painted her as a communist, as an atheist, and as just a destroyer of America generally.
I'm Mary Harris. I am speaking with Marie Griffith, the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor in the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis. We're talking about her book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Later on in the show, novelist Kathleen Hill will be here with her latest book. She read to us in the late afternoons about how her life has been illuminated by novels, plus Joan Silber with her novel, Improvement. You are listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We will be right back after a break. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to WNYC. And before the break, I was talking to Marie Griffith about Mary Steichen Calderon, who is a sex educator, also a devout Quaker. What I think is so interesting is that when I looked up her New York Times obit, it didn't mention her faith at all. Do we really remember her as a person of faith?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I think that's part of the issue, is that, you know, the way we think of these issues now is that religious people have resisted shifts in sexual norms and in gender roles and gender hierarchies, while secular people have either imposed those or have pushed really hard. And, you know, part of the point I want to make all along the way is this has not been so much a religious versus secular battle. It's really in many ways been a battle within religious circles themselves, as Christians have divided on these issues, and then, you know, the impact that's made on our larger politics. But I think you're absolutely right that we've forgotten the faith of people like Mary Steichen Calderon. Margaret Sanger herself was an Episcopal churchgoer. She left Catholicism, but she remained in the Episcopal Church. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that folks on the progressive side of these issues, many of them were quite devout in their own faith.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes for Mary Steichen Calderon was she would challenge young audiences by saying, "What's a four-letter word ending in K that means sexual intercourse?" And then she would give her answer, which was talk. And
that's right.
I just think that's kind of beautiful. Like, we don't talk about it enough.
That's right. Yeah, well, and as I said, SECUS is still around and I think doing all kinds of really good things. But now, of course, it tends to look, or at least we think of it as, quite secular. That's not entirely true. But yeah, she was quite something as a leader.
Yeah. You also illuminate the complicated relationship between people of faith and abortion. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the Clergy Consultation Service.
Absolutely. Well, the Clergy Consultation Service, another New York story here, which was really started in New York. It became a national organization, but created by ministers led by the Reverend Howard Moody, who was at Judson Memorial Church down in Greenwich Village, as a referral service for women to obtain safe abortions, even prior to the time when abortion was really legal and openly accessible.
And these were clergy referring people for abortions.
Yeah. Absolutely. The vast majority of them were men because the vast majority of clergy were men in that period. But many of them had seen the ravages of women in desperate circumstances, many of them poor or many of them unable to care for a child or whatever their reasoning being, out of desperation, seeking out abortions, paying huge amounts of money for them, and often becoming very ill or even dying from unsafe abortions. So Moody and his allies in the Clergy Consultation Service really saw it as their Christian duty to help these women by finding safe abortion providers and creating ways for them to have abortions. There was not a sense of abortion itself somehow being murder, certainly in the early stages of pregnancy. They had a wholly different way of thinking religiously about the issue of abortion.
Yeah, when Roe v. Wade came to the Supreme Court, were abortion rights associated with any one political party or religious institution?
Well, one crucial thing to remember is in 1973, January, is when the Roe v. Wade decision was announced, the vast majority of Americans were in favor of some kind of abortion reform. And that includes conservatives, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, 91% of Texas Baptists who were surveyed in 1972 or something in those early 70s said that abortion ought to be more accessible than it was then. I mean, people knew that there was this problem with unsafe abortions and women just coming into disastrous circumstances. So the one group that was very much opposed to abortion at that time was the Catholic Church and most ordinary Catholics, although even a good number of Catholics polled believed that there should be some access to abortion. Over the next several years, of course, many conservative Protestants shifted on that issue, whereas they had been perfectly in favor of abortion rights in 1973. Even Southern Baptist leaders praised the Roe v. Wade decision at that time. Over the next several years, they shifted dramatically in the other direction. So by the 80s, you've really got a very, very strong Protestant and Catholic anti-abortion movement. But you continue to have the progressive Christians, and not only Christians, of course, but you do have those folks who were very strongly on the pro-choice side of the issue. And that continues today, of course.
Why did it change? Like, who took the reins and said, oh, this is our issue?
Well, you know, it was very powerful leaders such as Phyllis Schlafly, of course, who herself was a Catholic, so she was always very opposed to abortion, but she was very popular among conservative Protestants in the 1970s. Jerry Falwell was extremely influential in fundamentalist and very, very conservative white Protestant circles on a whole range of issues, but that included abortion. So, you know, they hammered away at this issue that abortion was murder, it was killing babies, and that anyone who supported abortion rights or supported feminism, you know, was really destroying the nation. I mean, the stakes were incredibly high. It wasn't just about innocent babies, as they also talked about it. It was really about the soul of the nation itself.
Was it easier to make these attacks because the Roe v. Wade decision was really about privacy? It wasn't about equal rights?
Well, yeah, but, you know, they also, feminism itself was such an enemy for so many of these groups. Abortion was sort of one piece of that for them, but the entire feminist movement was really seen as evil and satanic. I mean, they fought very strongly against, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment. That's also the 1970s. Phyllis Schlafly leads the way in fighting for something that was really very simply about, you know, women being treated equally in all things. I mean, so feminism in some ways is the big thing that's tying all of that opposition together. Feminism is the thing that might destroy the family, children, and the whole country.
You know, in this moment right now, we are talking so much about sexual harassment, and you really get into the origins of this conversation in your book. So I'm hoping you can take me back to the 1975 public speak out at Cornell University. What happened there?
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, I think that is just the moment that historians look back to as sort of when women finally had this chance to talk about what had happened in their lives. And at Cornell, these were, you know, some of the low-wage workers, as well as students, as well as professors, different folks who were speaking out on this issue and discovering, well, not discovering, they probably knew how common this was, but sharing their stories among each other and finding some way to begin to feel empowered by that. So a whole legal movement begins to emerge around that as leaders like Catherine McKinnon and others begin to develop mechanisms for really fighting sexual harassment in the courts. And that was very, very influential over time. I'm particularly interested, of course, in the 1990s and a lot of what happened there, from the Clarence Thomas hearings and Anita Hill, all the way through Paula Jones and Bill Clinton and those sorts of things, because that also, of course, really shifted in some ways our conversation about sexual harassment.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, you have this quote from Gloria Steinem in your book that, you know, what's considered sexual harassment was actually just considered life for many women.
Just considered life. That's right. They just put up with it. Yes.
And I feel like we keep having these moments where we pull the curtain aside and we say, like, that is sexual harassment. And then the curtain just closes again. And it's just really interesting to watch in real time. So take me back to Anita Hill, because you do write a lot about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings. So tell me, were you watching them when they took place?
I was, yes. I was in graduate school at the time, and, you know, like most people in the country, I watched raptly and only took bathroom breaks at commercials, or I don't even know what we had to take breaks for, but, you know, and was very, very consumed by those. And, of course, it was an issue fraught with racial politics, fraught with all kinds of things, a lot of strong feelings that Clarence Thomas himself did not receive due process, that there was sort of hypocrisy on all sides. So, you know, it was just anyone who was alive at that time remembers just what a powerful, powerful and divided moment that was.
And a few years later, of course, Paula Jones spoke out about Bill Clinton.
Right. So it's really only about, I forget, 2.5 years or so that Paula Jones, you know, comes out. And really, her accusations against Bill Clinton, of course, were even far worse than what Clarence Thomas himself had been accused of. But the public reaction to that was very, very different. And one of the things I'm so interested in is the ways in which these reactions themselves were polarized. And I think, you know, show us that we tend to be primed to believe the stories of those with whom we agree politically, or those whose stories are sort of politically convenient for us. A lot of folks are coming out now and saying, okay, we should have been harder on Bill Clinton. Or Kristen Gillibrand even said he should have, you know, resigned because of all the things that he was pretty credibly accused of over time.
Yeah.
But at that time, feminists and other liberals and progressives stood up for Bill Clinton and in a very different way than they had reacted to Clarence Thomas.
Yeah. I mean, you write that in the aftermath of the Anita Hill testimony, the number of sexual harassment claims filed with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission and its state counterparts more than doubled. Did it make a difference?
That's the question we're having now, the conversation we're having now, isn't it? Because here we are in this very fraught moment around sexual harassment. I don't have to tell you. And it's that is the question. What has changed? And I think a lot of people, as we grapple with that, are recognizing that when sexual harassment is in the public eye, you know, when the media is covering it and hammering at it, and perpetrators or alleged perpetrators are getting embarrassed, you know, that seems to shift something. You know, everyone becomes more aware of their behavior, and you feel like something can shift. More people feel empowered to speak out and speak publicly. But in the past, at least, those moments have sort of ebbed and kind of died down. And once it's out of the public eye, that's the question, is how much really changes. And, you know, do we return to a state of normalcy where women just expect to be treated this way, or at least put up with it in order to advance their own careers? You know, I think we don't yet know what's changed and what hasn't, but it's very interesting, the moment that we're in right now, of course.
Yeah, the most depressing line in your book to me was, you know, history suggests how Trump may well have won not in spite of his attitude toward women, but because of it.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I was finishing the book during the 2016 campaign, and I think it was about January. The manuscript was due, and I thought, you know, the only thing I can write for an epilogue is, you know, this campaign and what just happened. Regardless of what all the issues were, there were many, many issues that went into that. You can't deny, but sexism and misogyny and tied up very much with racism and anti-Muslim sentiment and xenophobia and all the rest were very much a part of the voting patterns, the kind of outcome of that election. And the misogyny we kept seeing over and over again, rather than lowering Trump's popularity and his numbers, almost seemed to enhance his popularity, at least with some segment of the population. And I think that is extremely telling and something that we have to reckon with in this moment.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the particular Americanness of it. Because this summer, the supermodel Paulina Porizkova, she wrote this op-ed in the Times where she said, America made me a feminist. Like, she didn't think of herself as a feminist before she came here, but she felt like she needed that when she was here. And I just wonder if when you look at other countries, are there things that they're doing differently that we need to think about here?
Oh, that's a really good question. I have to confess I haven't really made those comparisons or drawn them so much. I would say I would be a real amateur at trying to draw comparisons or contrast to other countries. I do think that as Americans, we are sort of deeply steeped, because we're so deeply steeped in this assumption of our own destiny. I mean, even people who critique that idea, you know, we were all kind of raised in it in some way, especially if you're white. And you were kind of thought of as, you know, we have this great country, we're so lucky. And I think that does make it more difficult for people to stand up and resist or rock the boat without feeling that they might, you know, really put their careers, maybe their lives, their reputations at stake. And I do think that we can think about all of these issues around sex and gender controversies in those terms.
Yeah. I mean, you end the book with the Women's March. Did you attend?
I did. I flew from St. Louis to Washington, D.C. and was there, and, you know, was, as anyone was there, was just blown away by the power of it. And then going back to my hotel room that night and seeing the footage that was all over the country and all over the world. So that's really where I end the epilogue, because I had to get the manuscript in, but also because, you know, here's a moment of hope also, where you see one thing that happens is resistance does emerge in some way, and from all kinds of different venues. I mean, I have actually Catholic pro-life friends who were there very much, and they wanted a pro-life presence to be stronger at the march, and they were disappointed that it wasn't, but they said, I'm part of the resistance too, you know. And I think you see these kinds of interesting coalitions building that, you know, to me, there's hope in that.
That's a wonderful place to end our interview. I am so thrilled to have been speaking with you. I'm Mary Harris. I've been speaking with Marie Griffith, the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor in the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis, about her book, Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It was great to speak with you, Mary. Thank you.